tonight on Arena. We celebrate the lives and works of two of our greatest poets, Brendan Kennelly and Moira Vaughan-Tee. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, it has been a profoundly sad 24 hours for Irish poetry and indeed for the Irish literary community as news broke yesterday of the deaths of Brendan Kennelly and Moira Vaughan-Tee, two gifted Irish writers whose work has influenced the generations that have followed. Over the next hour, we'll celebrate those lives and their work of these two hugely significant literary figures who share the dual influences of the County of Kerry and the City of Dublin. Joining me, first of all, Chris Morrish of Trinity College Dublin and the poet John O'Donnell, and Brendan Kennelly's publisher and friend Neil Astley will be joining us on the phone. Later, I'll be speaking with poet Louis de Puer, Moya Cannon and Elaine de Quillenon to talk about Moira Vaughan-Tee. But let us start with Brendan Kennelly. And before we get stuck into the poets, let me apologise right now for the state of my rather ragged voice on this Monday evening. For obvious reasons, I'm broadcasting from home, but I'm delighted that both Chris Morrish and John O'Donnell have made their way into studio and that Neil Astley is joining us on the line. Chris, I'll start with you because of the Trinity College connection particularly. Brendan, of course, you taught there from the early 1960s through until 2006. You're now Seamus Heaney Professor of Irish Writing in that same college. When did you first meet?
I met him in the 1980s, and I think, you know, like so many people, a colleague of mine, Jarlath Killeen, has written about him today on the Trinity website, and Jarlath came there as an undergraduate in the 1990s. Jarlath says, you know, he remembers coming in as a first-year student and going into the lecture hall, and there was a sense of event, you know, that there weren't just the students in the lecture there. There were other staff, there were tourists, there were members of the public. It was an event. So, yeah, I mean, I met him in the mid-80s. I was doing a master's degree, and I remember doing a class with him on Yeats's theatre. And I was thinking about this the other day because I've just finished writing a book about Yeats's theatre, and I thought that's probably where that came from.
John O'Donnell, Chris mentioning that kind of atmosphere that was in Trinity College. Brendan Kennelly was, he was so much part of that college, but that college right in the city centre, he lived in the entire city centre, it strikes me, in the way he behaved and lived his life.
You'd meet him on the streets and he would be reciting poetry. Maureen Kennelly talks about him in the piece that Martin Doyle has assembled in the Irish Times of various tributes. She talks about him being like a walking jukebox of poetry, and you'd meet him on the corner of the street and he would produce a poem out of nowhere, and it wouldn't necessarily just be one of his own, it would be a poem from the 17th or 18th century, and he would recite it, and then he'd ask you about what you thought of the rugby match last week. He had an incredible range of interest in people and in things, and the time would go by very, very quickly on those street corners.
I'm sure, Neil Astley of Blood Axe Books, you, of course, since the 1980s, Blood Axe have been publishing Brendan's work, Neil. I'm sure you had many walks around the streets of Dublin with him while he recited poems, as John has just described.
Yes,
to us.
I mean, the walks weren't just, you know, we might be going from Trinity to go and have dinner at his favourite restaurant, the Troc, but that short distance actually took a long time because he'd be stopped every few yards. You know, someone would want to talk to him or hug him. He'd say a poem to them, just as John was saying, and he was so generous. I mean, he would slip money into the pockets of people very discreetly, not just people who were begging on the street, but people that he knew were on, you know, having hard times. Mm. And he did it with no one else noticing.
And
that generosity was extraordinary, and it extended into his writing as well, I think.
Yeah, and indeed, I think in recent times you had and have been working with him, I suppose, on a written version of what John just described to us in terms of an anthology of poetry.
Yeah, that's a book that actually got shelved when Brendan became ill, but I've gone back to it. And in the book, some of those, probably the same poems that that Chris was talking about, favourite poems of Brendan's from all times, you know, from Wyatt and Surrey and Shakespeare right up to the Irish poets that he knew himself. He's written commentaries to go with each of those poems, although there are gaps which I've been having to try and fill. And that's a book that we were planning to bring out on his birthday this year, but because of COVID and bookshops being closed, we held it back, and so now we'll publish it for his birthday next year.
And Chris, coming back to that idea of that ability that Brendan Kennelly had to quote from Chaucer, to quote from Shakespeare, to quote from Patrick Kavanagh, to quote from, you know, contemporary Irish poems, and yet talk about the rugby match in the same breath or the next breath. That facility he had, that was part of his popularity. He was a poet, really, that people knew as much as a man as a poet. He underplayed the poetic side of things in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, it's difficult to be a public poet, I think, now. It's more difficult than it was. In some ways, I won't say he's our last public poet, but he certainly played that role of the public poet in a way that's, I think, increasingly difficult to do. I think, I mean, the thing with Brendan was that he took poetry with the utmost seriousness while giving the impression of not taking himself with seriousness. And I think that combination is really what endeared him to people, because you realized, you know, here was somebody who really took his craft very, very carefully, and yet gave a sense of a kind of freedom in the world.
Let's have a listen to him speaking about poetry, in fact. This is Brendan Kennelly being interviewed by Gus Martin for the series Writer in Profile. This is a recording from 1976. And in this clip, Brendan Kennelly explains that for him, poetry is a sort of connection between the individual mind and then all of these minds and sensibilities that move outside you.
I would say that poetry is a sort of connection between the individual mind and all these minds and sensibilities that move outside you. Mm-hmm. The book you mentioned at the beginning, The Voices, I was trying there to connect with the world about me. Because, well, you have your inner life. I have my inner life, so has everybody. But there is also this world that's moving about you, and how do you make sense of it? Now, you try to connect with poetry, and you select images from that outer world which coincide with what you feel. And so they become kind of symbols of your own emotion. You literally create your own world.
And that's Brendan Kennelly in an interview there with Gus Martin from the series Writer in Profile from 1976. Neil Astley with me this evening, along with Chris Morrish and John O'Donnell, talking about Brendan Kennelly, whose death was announced over the weekend. Neil, you, as a publisher, you first came across Brendan in the 1980s. Just explain, because I think it's not it's linked in some ways to what we just heard, this idea of the very individual mind, but the big community as well.
Yes, and also Brendan, as he said in that clip, listening to voices, his poetry was not always his own voice. He wanted to bring the voices of everyone into his poems. I came across his work first in a magazine called The Rialto, which was run by a man called John Wakeman then, who actually was living in Ireland later. And he published a number of the poems from Cromwell, and this was the first time those poems had been read in Britain, published in Britain, because it came out from an Irish press called Beaverow in 1983. And I took up the challenge. I thought this book should be published in Britain as well, and that his work should you know, be heard much further. And so I met him in 1985. I met him in O'Neill's, in fact, in Dublin. And it was a time when he'd just come off the drink. I mean, you know, his drinking is legendary, and people know about that side of his life. But his ability to get through his alcoholism and actually break through to the other side, I met him at just that time. And it was also a time when he'd been in St. Pat's drying out with a whole bunch of really feisty women from the West, I think they were. And those women fed into the way he characterized the women in Medea. So that within a short time, the kinds of books we were publishing with him were that new Brendan, that new reinvented Brendan. And that's where the Book of Judas came from as well in 1991.
And if we take those two names, even just those two, Cromwell from 1983 and Judas, as you said, just a little bit later, Neil, hardly the most loved of men or of figures, no matter what tradition you come from.
Yeah, well, but Brendan wanted to get inside them and wanted to knock them about and knock about everyone's preconceptions, break through the stereotypes, sacrifice the sacred cows, and actually really build up a whole discussion and a whole engagement with everything that was that he found in those two figures.
Yeah. Those contradictions, Chris, I think you're going to come in on it. Those contradictions are vital to understanding Brendan Kennelly.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, when we think of the of Brendan as a person, I mean, everybody talks about that kind of twinkle in the eye and that kind of great belly laugh that he had and the kind of persona that, you know, quite often seemed, you know, sort of such a cheerful facing sort of persona. But he was a poet who was unafraid of the darkness, you know, who confronted darkness. And it's not just in Cromwell or the Book of Judas, but, you know, you go back to earlier poems, you know, poems like Dream of a Black Fox. And, you know, he's a poet who kind of stares the darkness in the face and says, you know, I see you. You're part of what is. You're part of the world. And I think as a poet who was open to the world, he was open to all of it. And, I mean, to me, that's right, what I see coming through the poetry now.
Yeah. And indeed, the poem that you have chosen to share, maybe part of it with us, John O'Donnell, My Dark Fathers, again speaks to that contradiction within his mind, both the love and the dark, the bright and the dark.
Yes, I mean, he would be celebrated for his charisma and his generosity of spirit and his kind of high good humour. But just before I read a little bit of The Dark Fathers, I think it's interesting that so many people have identified his ability to see the other side. Katie Donovan talks about him honouring and his sympathy towards the scapegoat. And if I might say so, that he was a kind of, if I can use the phrase, a kind of a counsel for the defence of people who might otherwise not have had too many defenders. And, you know, that's why we're going to miss him even more these days. Because we need people who will act as counsel for the defence. This is a poem called, just a verse from the poem called My Dark Fathers, which is about the famine, and it's about the way music and song disappeared and dancing disappeared during the famine. And he talks about, you know, Ireland becoming the grave of song during the famine. And so it tracks back to a talk that he heard by Frank O'Connor, but it also, there's a reference in it to a woman dying, which is later referred to by Ivan Boland. So there are all these kind of counterpoints and references. But I'll just read one verse. Skeletoned in darkness, my dark fathers lay unknown and could not understand the giant grief that trampled night and day, the awful absence moping through the land. Upon the headland, the encroaching sea left sand that hardened after tides of spring. No dancing feet disturbed its symmetry, and those who loved good music ceased to sing.
And that's John O'Donnell reading from My Dark Fathers, one of the poems of Brendan Kennelly, whose life and work we're celebrating this evening. Neil Astley, as his publisher, obviously, Neil, you would have worked very closely with him. He had this immediacy, this wonderful facility to communicate, and it comes right through the poetry. What was he like in that, you know, editor-poet relationship? How did that work?
It quickly developed into a stage where we were both on each other's wavelengths, and I knew what he was doing, and he would accept my suggestions. I cut some of those big books quite considerably, and he was happy to be cut back. But the editorial sessions we had were very lively. You know, I would come over and spend a day at Trinity having gone through stuff. And, you know, it was uproarious, those meetings we had. And he was just open to everything. It was quite extraordinary. He wanted to improve the poems, even though he was the brilliant poet. So any suggestions I made, he would take on and sort of read them aloud, and suddenly they were his. They were his new readings of the poem, in a sense. He took them on, and suddenly it wasn't as though I'd been editing him. It was as though he'd been editing himself with me as a kind of catalyst.
Chris Morash, the idea of taking his work quite seriously in the way that Neil has suggested there, but never being self-important, that's a hugely significant aspect of Kennelly's work.
Yeah, no, I think it is. And I mean, I think it's what allowed him to present his poetry to the public in a way that people, you know, accepted him and just loved him. I mean, you know, the kind of accounts we've heard of him, you know, walking down the street in Dublin and people stopping him on the street and saying, you know, I saw you on the Late Late Show, and he responding to that and you know, kind of living with that. And at the same time, you know, writing a book like The Book of Judas, which is challenging poetry, you know, which actually, I mean, you know, Neil can probably tell us the figures, but, you know, it actually sold well. It was a book of poetry that actually, you know, reached a wide public. So I think that's tremendously important. And, you know, we shouldn't really forget that about him.
And I wanted to listen to a poem, Brendan reading, which I think gives us a sense to how he could, the famous Poetry My Arse collection, or a big long poem, you know, or Guff was another collection, wasn't it, that he brought out in more recent times. So he was constantly, you know, pulling the rug from underneath any self-importance that there might be around the world of poetry. And in this poem that we're about to hear from, reading from a three-year-old, this is written for his then three-year-old daughter, Doodle Kennedy. And sadly, Doodle died earlier this year. But here's the poem.
Will the flowers die? And will the people die? And every day, do you grow old? Do I grow old? No, I'm not old. Do flowers grow old? Old things, do you throw them out? Do you throw old people out? And how you know a flower that's old? The petals fall from flowers. And do the petals fall from people too? Every day more petals fall until the floor where I would like to play, I want to play, is covered with old flowers and people all the same, together lying there with petals fallen on the dirty floor. I want to play. The floor? You come and sweep the floor with the huge broom. The dirt you sweep. What happens all the dirt? What happens all the dirt? You sweep from flowers and people. What happens all the dirt? Is all the dirt what's left of flowers and people? All the dirt there in a heap under the huge broom that sweeps everything away? Why you work so hard? Why brush and sweep to make a heap of dirt? And who will bring new flowers? And who will bring new people? Who will bring new flowers to put in water where no petals fall onto the floor where I would like to play? Who will bring new flowers that will not hang their heads like tired old people wanting sleep? Who will bring new flowers that do not split and shrivel every day? And if we have new flowers, will we have new people to keep the flowers alive and give them water? And will the new young flowers die? And will the new young people die? And why?
Brendan Kennelly reading his poem from a three-year-old. Chris Morish, the innocence, the seeming innocence of that, and the ability to get what sounds like a very simple poem down the way he has done it there. That's an incredible feat.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and I think, you know, you can kind of follow his poetic craft through his career as well. And, you know, the time he wrote a poem like that, he's writing kind of in the 60s. He's writing kind of longer form poems. You know, when he gets to, say, around the time of Cromwell, he starts really working with sonnets a lot more. And then you get to the late poems. You know, there's a collection, Martial Art, from 2003, where he's writing these little short sort of four-line poems, these little bursts. So you can see him, you know, experimenting with the form of poetry all the time. But it's always in the service of that voice. And when you hear, particularly when you hear him read it, there are so many end rhymes and internal rhymes and alliteration and he's using all the tricks. The poems dance, you know, that they have a lilt, they dance in a way that's not true of very many of his contemporaries, I think, that he really is alert to the music of the poetry.
Well, we'll continue with our celebration of the life and work of Brendan Kennelly after these. And welcome back to Monday Night's Arena, where we're celebrating the life and work of Brendan Kennelly. And later in the programme, we will be speaking also about Moira Wakati. Just some of your text reaction to what we've been doing. Hello, Sean and Arena, says Rosemary in Delgany in County Wicklow. Thanks for your tribute to Brendan Kennelly. I was so lucky and blessed to be a student of his in TCD in the early 1970s and remember the excitement of his lectures. He was almost like a rock star. I wrote to him in mid-2009 to thank him for the joy of literature he imparted to me, and today I reread his lovely reply. He was a great teacher and a wonderful character. I feel very sad today, but happy to remember him. As I said, Rosemary in Delgany in County Wicklow sharing those thoughts with us. And still with us, John O'Donnell, Chris Morrish and Neil Astley.
Yeah, it's interesting the students come in there, Sean, because the students became disciples of Brendan's. You know, they really did. They stuck to him, and they've all said how memorable their encounters with them were in and out of class.
Yeah, indeed. Rock star is the right term for how many of the students felt about him, I think. But also joining us now is Moira Cannon, who will be speaking to us about Moira Wakati later on as well. But Moira, it is that teaching aspect of Brendan that I think you would like to speak to. You made a real point of going to Brendan Kennelly's workshops at Listowel. What kind of teacher was he in that setting?
Oh, he was wonderful, Sean. He was wonderful. I just can't believe he's gone. I can't believe that two of the grown-ups all gone this weekend, himself and Moira Wakati. Mm. No, I went along to those workshops, and there were people from all arts and parts in Ireland, and he just created a space where everybody was comfortable to air their work and, you know, to have it very gently pummeled into shape. He didn't say very much. He really had a wonderful way of standing back or sitting back and, I don't know, getting people to talk among themselves. And he would add something maybe at the end, something very little but very important very often. And I remember in particular as well, he would, okay, sometimes then, I think in the mornings he used to, you know, people used to bring in their own work. And I think in the afternoons he used to usually bring in a poem. I remember a marvellous elucidation he did of Patrick Kavanagh's Advent. Mm. And of course, he was a man about town. You used to see him. He spent a lot of time in the Blana bookshop. You'd see them there, etc. But a wonderfully generous, spirit. And, you know, when he met you afterwards, you know, he'd ask you about that poem, etc. And really, you know, was marvellously encouraging, really, you know.
Yeah. In fact, you mentioned Kavanagh there, and he was a great admirer of Kavanagh's. And let's listen to him speak about his great love of Patrick Kavanagh as a person and as a poet. This is from 1999. And in the midst of this, he just does what we were speaking about earlier. He suddenly recites a verse of Kavanagh's poem, A Man in You.
He believes in poetry, even though it cost him his life in many ways. And at the end of his life, one day I said to him, what do you think of your life? I said to him. And he uttered a few phrases. And I made a little verse out of it. And he said, I want no easy grave, he said to me, where those who hated me can come and stare, slip down upon a servile knee, muttering their phony public prayer. In the wilds of Norfolk I'd like to lie, no commemorative stone, no sheltering trees, far from the hypocrite's tongue and eye, safe from the praise of my enemies. And that was a moment when I saw, when he said that, I knew I was in the presence of somebody totally genuine. And since that day, I have read him through and through. And as I said at the beginning, I just love him.
I just love him. That's Brendan Kennelly speaking of Patrick Kavanagh in that recording from 1999. A couple of things that strike me, Chris Morrish, about that. First of all, the love of Kavanagh and how important that was to him, that poetic voice that Kavanagh had. But he had an equal admiration, maybe of a different kind, for Yeats.
That's right. Yeah. He had an admiration for like a huge range of poetry. I mean, he had an admiration, I think, for Yeats. Just Yeats as a poet, as somebody committed to poetry. But he also, I mean, as you say, there was a commitment there, you know, to Kavanagh. I think he loved poetry. I mean, that's what comes across there, that when he meets somebody like Kavanagh, he sees somebody there who has made a kind of commitment to poetry. And yet he was able to combine this, and this goes back to something we were saying earlier, he was able to combine this with almost a mistrust of poetry sometimes, in a healthy way. You know, calling a collection guff or poetry my arse. in a way, constantly challenging himself and challenging us to say, this is important and this is serious.
To a certain extent, John O'Donnell, I think one could argue that there might be a touch of the Kerryman and the Dubliner in those two aspects. He obviously, great love of Kerry, his native county, but he equally loved the city. How did those two aspects of his personality merge together, do you think?
Well,
the countryman, the city man.
That's a great... I mean, he obviously, you know... at times played the professional Kerryman in Dublin, but he, and as you may know, he played for Kerry Miners against Dublin in the minor final in 1954. And if we talk about his long memory for poetry, but he says back in Ballylongford, they had very long memories. He said when they're putting up a statue to him in Ballylongford, some fella came up to him and said, "Aren't you the little boy who lost us the All-Ireland Minor Final?"
Yeah, they don't forget.
So they don't forget. Unless you have a winner's medal, you're forgotten, or at least you're obliterated from history. But I knew people who played sports in Dublin who he engaged with very easily. So, and he was a figure around the town. If you were talking about Yeats earlier on, he was much more my idea of the smiling public man than Yeats talks about in Among Schoolchildren. You know, he really had a word for everybody, and that he engaged with people about all sorts of different things and about things about Dublin. I mean, I remember sitting on a corner one time at the street and he was talking to the Lord Mayor. I think he was talking about bicycles. And that conversation could have gone anywhere and could have gone on for quite a long time. But he just had that kind of charisma and that generosity of spirit that endeared him to so many people all over Ireland.
And those two aspects, Neil Astley, of his personality, how did they manifest them? I suppose the Kerry-Dublin thing would be, the nuances of that would be maybe a little bit more appreciated in this country, but how did they manifest themselves to you?
Well, there was that openness he had. On those walks around Dublin, he listened to everyone. He heard their stories. He turned their stories into poetry. And in a way, coming from Kerry, Kerry is a great storytelling place, isn't it? It's a great musical place. And there were those influences of stories and music and Irish poetry that all fed into his work. It's a whole mix. I mean, that poem which he read, Poem from a Three-Year-Old, that's a whole series of questions. And all his poetry asks questions. Doesn't always give answers, but it engages with those questions. And it's universal in its appeal.
Sure, there's a story that he told about just taking up questions. He says that when a woman in Dame Street came up to him and recently said, "How long have you been writing?" And he said, "About 50 years." And she said, "Stick at it." She said, "You never know, you might make a career of it yet." And he loved that, and he put it in the introduction to one of Neil's books. So you know, he was great at taking a joke and then telling it against himself.
There was also the story he told of walking across O'Connell Bridge and a man coming up to him and saying, "How can you possibly defend Cromwell?" and punching him in the face. And then the man was so shocked at having done that to him, Brendan took him off to a bar and gave him a drink, and they sat down and had a great talk together.
Yeah, well, I was going to, you know, ask about his legacy, which is often the final question, but I think you've given it to us in some ways, Neil Astley, in what you've just said. And thanks so much to Neil Astley, to John O'Donnell and to Chris Morrish for sharing their thoughts on the late Brendan Kennelly, whose life and work we're celebrating this evening. We'll be back to celebrate the work of Moira McIntyre shortly. But before that, let us go to Listowel Writers Week. We should go back to Kerry, I think. This is from 2018. And Brendan Kennelly, reading the poem, I think perhaps one of his most beloved and popular poems, Begin.
Begin again to the summoning birds, to the sight of light at the window. Begin to the roar of morning traffic all along Pembroke Road.
Every beginning is a promise, born in light and dying in dark. Determination and exaltation of springtime, flowering the way to work. Begin to the pageant of queuing girls, the arrogant loneliness of swans in the canal. Bridges linking the past and future, old friends passing, though with us still. Begin to the loneliness that cannot end, since it, perhaps, is what makes us begin. Begin to wonder at unknown faces, at crying birds in the sudden rain, at branches stark in the willing sunlight, at seagulls foraging for bread, at couples sharing a sunny secret, alone together, while making good. Though we live in a world that dreams of ending, that always seems about to give in. Something that will not acknowledge conclusion insists that we forever begin.
Brendan Kennelly reading his poem Begin, and that was recorded at Listowel's Writers' Week in 2018. We turn our attention now to another great loss to the world of poetry, Moira Wakati, whose death was also announced over the weekend. Delighted to be joined by the poet Louis Dupuyr, who is also the director of the Centre for Irish Studies at NUI Galway, edited on Parochta Mirultuk, the Miraculous Parish from 2012, first ever collection of Moira Wakati's work translated into English. And also still with us is Moya Cannon. And maybe I come to you first on this, Moya, because we've heard so much about how Moira Wakati really was a trailblazer in many ways. How important a role model was she for young women as a poet in the way that she lived her life and in the way that she lived her poetry?
Well, she was immensely important. I mean, she was probably, I think she was the only woman on our Leaving Cert course. It was triumvirate of herself and Máirtín Ó Díreán and Fiona Riordan. And so she was always there. That's what I just can't believe, is that she has now passed away at the age of almost 100. And she, just her intelligence and her warmth were manifest any time you met her. And of course, her courage in the 1960s, to very early 1960s, to head off to the Congo. To meet Conor Cruise O'Brien in defiance of all the conventions of the age. But she'd been writing very courageous sensual poetry and publishing it right through the 50s. And I had a lovely experience with her. I was writer in residence in Kerry in 1996, and the librarian there, Kathleen Brown, suggested I get a poet come down to invite a poet to give a reading and also to read to the children in schools. And so I thought, well, Moira Wakati, with her links to Kerry, was an obvious person. And she came down, and I was just knocked out by her reading to a group of girls in secondary school. I suppose they were Leaving Cert students, or maybe fourth, fifth year students. But she was so frank, so courageous, and not an ounce of condescension or patronization, you know. And, you know, spoke of just... of the love poetry she had written as a young woman, and said that, you know, she was fortunate that she wrote it in Irish, because never passed the censor in English.
Yes, many people have said that about her work. And ultimately, Louis Dupuyr, that is what she is. She is a love poet, and a very sensuous love poet at that, Louis.
Oh, absolutely, and continued to produce love poetry of extraordinary intensity right through the whole course of her life, up to and including the elegies she wrote for Conor Cruise O'Brien, her husband, shortly after his death, which I think are amongst her best work. And, you know, that really is very unusual, to have a poet continuing to find new voices and new ways of articulating deep emotion right into her 80s. You know, this is a poet, after all, who had described herself as an occasional and part-time poet, whose debut collection, which came out in 1956, came out when she was 34. And then there's almost 20 years passage before the second collection comes out, and she's over 50 when the second very slight collection comes out. So in terms of scale, if you're looking at the number of poems, her output is relatively slight. But if you measure it against any other scale, to produce work at the highest possible level right through the whole course of her life makes her absolutely extraordinary, I think.
And obviously one of the hugely important aspects of the writing of Máire Bhacatí is the reality and the fact that it is written in the Irish language. Let us hear herself, Máire Bhacatí, speaking about how English is her everyday language, but she feels free that she can write with authority in Irish. She's speaking to Olivia O'Leary here in 2000.
English is certainly my everyday language, and it's the language in which I write prose with ease. But the language that means most to me, I mean, the language emotionally, that touches me is certainly Irish. And I feel that when I write in Irish, I write with authority. I know when I write in English that it's a pale reflection of what I could write in Irish.
So you can be more colourful, perhaps?
I can't help being colourful. I mean, that's the nature of the language. The turf smoke clings to it, you know. It is very difficult to write, at least for me, to write detached prose in Irish. And of course, detached prose is not what you want to write if you're writing poetry.
I just love that phrase. That's Máire Bhacatí speaking about writing in Irish to Olivia O'Leary in the year 2000. I love, Louis, the way she says, oh, I can't really, you know, all my colour is in Irish. And then she says, the turf smoke clings to it. Now, what an amazing phrase to come up with to describe the use of the Irish language in her work.
Yeah, but in a way, she's being a little disingenuous and inappropriately modest there in crediting the language itself with what effectively is an accomplishment which is her own. You know, a Stradivarius may be an extraordinary instrument, but it requires the musician to draw the music from it. And I think really it's Máire Bhacatí's ability to draw on all of the resources of the Irish language. She's a scholar of the language, so she's able to draw on the literary tradition. She sees that also as linking her directly to her mother, who lectured in medieval Irish poetry and bardic poetry. So she claims that inheritance on one side, and then the vernacular tradition of the West Kerry Gaeltacht on the other side. So, you know, it's very disingenuous, if you like, to talk about the turf smoke, because here you have an upper middle class, extraordinary, powerful, highly educated Dublin woman who manages to make the language of the West Kerry Gaeltacht an instrument on which she plays almost better than anybody else is capable of playing. And on the one level, there's extraordinary artifice and formal dexterity and brilliance, ingenuity in her work. But what you're struck by more than anything else is the intensity of the utterance itself. And sometimes you have this feeling that it's the power of the emotion itself, which is almost overwhelming, and that it's only barely checked by the mastery of language and form. And then you realize when you look again, actually, that's not it at all. It's intensified by her formal brilliance and her ability to manipulate the Irish language to give expression to these very, very disturbing feelings very often. She's somebody who says she only ever wrote under pressure of deep feeling that required, that compelled utterance.
Yeah. You mentioned Moya Cannon about that moment when you were the writer in residence in Kerry, and where she spoke to a group of secondary school students. I believe one of the poems that she read on that day was Culla an Gaisti. Maybe give us a little bit of context for this poem, Moya, because I have Máire Bhacatí reading the opening stanzas of it, as Gaeilge and in English as well. So give us the context for what she's speaking about here.
it's she read it beautifully, and she just spoke of how the phrase apparently is a phrase that's used in Kerry. I hadn't heard it before. The heroes sleep, and she says it's when a child is playing out all day in the sunshine, and they come home and they're really tired, and they just fall dead asleep in your arms. And she wrote it for her adopted son, and it's just incredibly tender. And just brings in the whole fact of his adoption, and he was black, and she celebrates it. She said, "It's my folliach the stach, folliach being sort of new blood," and it's just a mixture of the passion and the tenderness and the intelligence which characterizes all her work, and it's an absolutely magnificent poem.
Yeah, let's listen to her reading the opening stanza again. And this is from the programme In My Life from 2000, presented by Olivia O'Leary.
I call it the hero's sleep, Colon Rashgig. Kyaunin Mogulach Milich Marsmeer. Avakin Yasuch the Hidden Thail. De the Vahasa is Nadigim Hri. De the Vahasa Ferahachanti. A railhin Maidana Heinig again. The heroes sleep. Little clustered head, sweet as the blackberry. Little foreign sun, my part of this world. Welcome and nest in my heart. Welcome under the rafters of this house. Little morning star, come from a long way off.
And that's Maura Wakati there reading the opening stanzas of Cuddle and Gashi, or as she says, she calls it the hero's sleep. Wonderful opening stanza. And Louis de Prayer, that, as Moya Cannon telling us beforehand, for her adopted son, the love jumps off the page. But there was a lot of love for Conor Cruz as well.
Absolutely. And it's there right up to the very end. I don't know, would I maybe read one
yes,
of
do,
those
please.
Poems? And you have this really strong sense here, you know, the way when you read sometimes old Chinese poetry, it's almost like as if it's not poetry at all. It's direct utterance. It's simply presenting a feeling in an unadorned way. But in Maura Wakati's case, this extraordinary dexterity that she had, there's a point comes where she moves beyond that into a kind of a clarity and simplicity. So you get the sense almost as if the emotion itself and the language are a single thing. It's a poem called Kyaun Bliana. Kori Machina Chondolta Ye An Chre. Filim Spisri Sanesh Lena Le Agus Arigad Kursuch. Tashnach the Fos Ihr Nakila. Sheenim Lahashan Chirp Malabik. 1 year after, I arrange my memory in readiness for the grave, put spices in her shroud and silver coins. The snow is still on the cemetery ridge. I lie down beside the body on my bed.
And that's Louis de Puer there reading the poetry of Maura Wakati. I didn't get the title of that, Louis. Maybe you just repeat it for me. Oscailia and Imerla, Masha the Holy.
It's Kyaun Bliana Oscailing and 1 year after in English.
Kyaun Bliana and one year after. Again, there's a kind of a sensuality in that Moya Cannon that Maura Wakati brings to her poetry. She really was writing about things, and I think Louis referred to this earlier on, that if she'd been writing them in English, she'd have landed herself in big trouble. But in the latter part of her career, she also started to write about the domestic. A lot of people, or there were those who complained a little bit about that.
Well, as I say, a poet, as I say, it's one of the privileges of a poet to write or to write about anything that comes into their head. So I think she was entirely within her rights in doing that. She was full of surprises. She really was, and full of just a tremendous intellectual energy as much as anything else.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, go ahead. Sorry, Maya.
No, I'm just when Louis was reading that, I'd just come across earlier a tiny little love poem that she wrote for Conor Cruz O'Brien when he went off. Obviously, it must have been just before she headed to off to the Congo to join him. And if you like, I'd be very happy to read it.
Yes, do please.
It's called Ershiel de Rina Oria from Africa. ní chreidfaré a chardad na gardad. A chó tanto a rís as baile ní isfala. Bíon a deoch ní mienlam. Grim an ocris, brian a liathe, ní hocú taim. Ná fáin rá ada ar siúl wim, ná trust in sa bhá dhuanach, fíl a ghrá.
And that's Maya Cannon. And tánam don dán sin a rís dom Máise de Hollé, Maya?
Ar siúl do gine áirithe chun na Africa, as a certain person goes to Africa.
Yeah, and no prizes for guessing who the certain person is in that case.
Go ahead. It would appear that she hadn't planned to follow him, actually, judging from this. So it was an impulse. And there's a lovely story that she tells. She said her parents were very annoyed about it. And her mother was, I think in some recent interview, in a recent documentary, she said, her mother said, you know, they were discussing, and her father said, why did she have to go to the Congo? And her mother said, Sean, when I was young and in love with you, I would have followed you to the ends of the earth.
The right answer, I think, from a mother to a father. Also joining us now is Elaine Ní Chuileánán, Egar Michael, with Asvaitling and Ocht. Elaine, what have we lost in Máire Wakati, do you think, Elaine?
A link, I suppose, that goes back to the early years of our culture, the culture that we have now. A great example, except that her example will remain, of course, her memory. A most enterprising and inventive person. She was translating Rilke, published in 2013. So she was restless and determined, and I think she's an example to all of us.
And what was the particular quality that you think her poetry had that made it so particular and so special, Elaine?
Well, there's a directness about it. There's a saying things that are terribly important to her, and that somehow from the language and the rhythm of it, you get the sense of how determined her speech is. I think that there's also a very strong emphasis on choice. I was looking at a poem of hers, which we published in Ciphers in 1991, so 30 years ago, but it's an extraordinary poem about going to the funeral of a young woman who had taken her own life and looking around at the older people there, and it ends, "Women shanis le kuitin, raunig shisha a wallert. She chose otherwise." And I think that sense of choice, even a tragic choice, is there in her work from the very beginning.
As a wonderful line that, Elaine, Rowney Shisha a Wallerch, and Louis Dupuyer, I suppose, I don't know if there was much Rowney of a Wallerch in the case of The Miraculous Parish, but I believe choosing the translations and working on the translations, she wanted a lot of opinions. She wanted a lot of opposites, possibly, to be given to her.
She was actually very gracious and very generous. She had done translations herself of all of her work and was dissatisfied with them. So she was very open to the translation project. And Elaine was one of the translators that was involved. We made it a precondition for being involved that people had to be fluent and comfortable with the Irish language and its literary traditions. But Moy herself had the last word. Wherever there was a dispute or a question to be resolved, she was the final authority, as I think she was on probably everything that came under her jurisdiction.
Final words from you, Maya Cannon, on Máire Wakati.
We will miss her greatly. She was sort of a kind of a mother figure in the poetry world.
And Elaine Ní Chuileánán.
Well, yes, and the exemplar. I think she's the beginning of something that happened in the writing of poetry in Irish and in Ireland, that just made such a mark that we'll never forget it.
And finally, Louis, briefly if you could, because I want to finish with one of her poems.
Again, she's exemplary in her work and a very difficult example to follow in her life. Extraordinary integrity and prepared to take the consequences of very brave decisions throughout her life.
Let us listen to Máire Ócáidí then, Chun Craic Nua Nocht, Ag Léamh an Don Muiréad Aspáille, reading the poem Muiréad Aspáille.
Muiréad Aspáille, Margaret away from home. Chianíos chéire chapana, chéris chéire flátaí a téab, sarar chéníos gráus imi hér sýri, cred me leta chalín vig, vi eachtan tánir chúag a héag. I bought 4 chops. I put 4 plates to heat before I remembered that you were gone on holidays. Believe me, little girl, it was an inkling of the bitterness of death.
Máire Ócáidí and her poem Muiréad Aspáille. And that is our lot for this programme this evening. My thanks to Louis Dupuir, Máire Cannon and Elaine Ní Chuilleanán for sharing their thoughts on Máire Ócáidí, and earlier John O'Donnell, Chris Morrish and Neil Astley for speaking to us about Brendan Kennelly. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.